It seems like everyone is either starting a side hustle or becoming their own boss. And you know what they're hearing a lot? It's the sound of another sale on Shopify, the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Sign up for a £1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/sell23, all lowercase. Whether you're selling loafers or peace lilies, Shopify simplifies selling online and in person. Covering all sales channels, from a shop front POS system to its all-in-one e-commerce platform, Shopify even gets you selling across social media marketplaces. With their 24/7 help and extensive business course library, Shopify is ready to support your success every step of the way. Go to shopify.co.uk/sell23 to take your business to the next level today. That's shopify.co.uk/sell23.
You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 228 is John Robinson, nicknamed JR, when he became a mainstay studio drummer for Quincy Jones in the late 70s. And he is, perhaps today, the most recorded session drummer in the world. You're right now hearing one of the many songs he played on, Steve Winwood's Higher Love. That intro drum riff was something he came up with entirely on his own. After gigging as a teen in the mid-70s with the Tommy Dorsey Band, he then joined Rufus in 1978, just as their singer Chaka Khan was leaving, though she came back and did many things with him. So Quincy Jones was producing one of the Rufus records, began to invite JR to play on various sessions. So for instance, Michael Jackson's Off the Wall album and his Bad album. Although during the recording of Thriller, he was actually touring as band leader for John Fogerty. He played on many of the biggest hits for Whitney Houston, Lionel Richie, the Pointer Sisters, Donna Summer, Diana Ross, Wilson Phillips, Seal. It is a very long list. Today we're going to talk about first a song he wrote and recorded with Maya Azucena for the soundtrack to the HBO documentary The Bronx, USA. In 2020, the song is called Gonna Be All Right. He has recorded two solo albums. We're going to be discussing Flight 81 from the first of these, Feng Shui, from 2004, and look all the way back to his time in Rufus with You're Really Out of Line from Seal in Red, 1983. We'll conclude by listening to a track from one of his instrumental groove jazz bands, SRT. The song is called Tal Shaya from Vanguards of Groove, 2023. Throughout this, I will be referring to the immediate impetus for this interview, his new autobiography, King of the Groove, where he gives us the story of his parts on over 50 Grammy-winning songs, over 200 U.S. Billboard Hot 100 songs, including We Are the World. For more information, see johnjrrobinson.com. For more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And to support the effort, go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. So I will play a little bit of Higher Love by Steve Winwood from Back in the High Life again, 1986, to warm people up, because this book that you have written, King of the Groove, is mostly stories about your many sessions when you are adding something really significant. And in fact, you give a piece of advice like, don't be afraid to ask for songwriting credit or something. But I don't think you got credit for this one, even though this was just a jam of you, for I understand, by yourself. Is that right? With this intro to Higher Love.
I had already cut the basics with the kick, snare, and hat, and did a couple of crashes and some limited tom fills. And I was just out by myself, an hour later with the snares turned off and starting to just kind of blow like a timbali pattern. And, I was like kind of digging it. I go, wow, this is cool. The light bulb hadn't come on yet about maybe I should insert this into this song I just played. But, God works funny. My brain works funny. That way I'll automatically start something even though I hadn't added two and two. So I was playing it maybe not knowingly that I was going to ask them or they're going to ask me to plug it into that song. That's really what happens. We went back, got a new track, and I overdubbed it from top to bottom.
Okay, so even though you came up with that part and it was a whole, it's sort of the signature of the song as it starts, as somebody who's contributed so much from a rhythmic angle, which, you can't copyright drum parts. Like, under what circumstances, and it doesn't seem like this was one, would you say, hey, can I get a co-write credit?
This was not one because the song was already intact.
Okay.
The lyrics were mostly written, the melody was written, and the groove has nothing to do with it, unfortunately.
I see. So it's a matter of order of operations. So even if it was somebody taking your groove and building a whole thing around it, well, they're still doing the melody and the chords and all the copyrightable stuff. But because it had that as its foundation, then you could say, oh, I was a co-writer in that. But if you add after the fact, no matter how innovative or interesting... I guess if you change time signatures, if they add a whole extra bridge because of what you did, then that's, you know.
Well, it was changed time signatures by Tom Lord Alge. But I'll give you another example. Herb Albert's Rise. And when you listen to that bass part that was composed and laid down initially, firstly, from Abraham Laboriel Sr., he's going, bong, bong, ta-gong, ta-gong, doom, gong, gong, ta-gong. Oh, there was nothing other than that. Any drummer in the world can put a groove underneath that, and then that's where that song came from. I do not believe Abraham got writer's credit for that. So that's the opposite of what we're talking about.
Yep. Well, let's get to some songs that we had picked out that you did write from the ground up. So just to give something recent from the Bronx, USA soundtrack, Gonna Be All Right, which you co-wrote, co-arranged with Maya Azucena. How do you pronounce it?
Maya Azucena.
Azucena. Yes. So I see that you're not only drumming on this, but you did the programming. You did is it programmed bass or is it played bass?
I played the bass on a synth. Well, I'm a keyboard player also, so.
Yes.
Yeah.
But play the bass on the synth, not, okay.
Well, and I, listen, I got a whole bevy of guitars back here, and I do play that also. It depends on how difficult the part is.
Sure.
And with all this new technology that I use in Pro Tools, if I feel that it doesn't hurt the song and it helps the song, then I'll go with it. If not, I will call a bass player of my choosing, whether it be Leland or Neil, and have them come out here and put bass on it. So Maya is just a lovely, lovely woman from Brooklyn who lived over in Istanbul for about 10 years. Her and I met on a Lexus push down at, I don't know, it was Staples or something. I don't know where the hell we were. And we were doing this gig together, and I really dug her. And her and I wrote incredibly well together. We've written a bunch of songs. That happened to be at the right timing when I was scoring a movie by the great director Danny Gold called The Bronx, USA.
All right, well, let's hear it in full, and then we'll talk more.
Through all the plight that we have faced, we'll be alright. Broken down, born and raised, got the
Okay, so yeah, tell order of operations here. Was this you two writing away from recording equipment, or was this you laying down a thing that then she came up with lyrics or something? What was the, do you remember how this one came together?
When I write, I do write differently depending on the situation. Like a lot of people think, you know, because I'm a drummer of 62 years of playing drums, oh, you must start with the drums. And that is not the case at all. I mean, I'm a piano player, and so I'll start with some sort of a melodic intent. So Maya was living in New York at the time, and I'm out here in Ventura County, California. So because of the distances, I gave Maya some blocks, and I go, I want you to play with these blocks. And she sings so well in tune that she would send me back rough wave files of her singing melody ideas. I would have her via distance sing in tempo, and then I would plug these in. And that's basically how this thing was born. The whole way the world was, you know, during that 10 years ago or 8 years ago was, you know, we want everything to be all right. And it had to have been the theme line of this movie about these young kids from DeWitt High School in New York, and about, you know, everything's going to be all right, you know, even though they were very needy children, that blended with the movie theme. So that's how it started that way. And then finally, Maya was out here in Los Angeles. I brought her out here to my studio, and we proceeded to layer it down. Now, there's a different version of this. We ended up tailoring this version for the movie and brought in a guy named Javed, a little young rapper who was in the movie and at that high school. So we tied it in and basically wrapped it around this film. And it became the signature song of the film going out.
Yes, the version that I have had access to on the soundtrack album has Javed and Clegg Ferrell as the two rappers. So they're both people in the film.
That is correct.
Yeah, I was wondering about this. So yeah, in terms of leaving space for this to happen, was that written in blocks? Yeah, I guess that makes a lot of sense. So you could sort of move things around and like, okay, let's add some space for the rapper, and then we'll do some stuff so that like the second time the raps come in, you do this layered set of harmonizations with this crazy synth that comes over it. Yeah. Any thoughts about incorporating their bits and making it actually fit with the whole song?
Well, what I had to do is take our Maya and I's original version and lock it, like in the studio, I'd lock it to film, which is on the screen, and I would look at what it's needed, and then I would go in and literally edit. It's not unlike how they do film, you know, a music to film today. You know, you may have 16 bars of something, but then all of a sudden there's a tempo change or 3/8 notes that needs to go to somewhere and then pause or something. So what we did was we listened to the producer and basically educated, produced Javed to be a rapper because he was an actor in the film. And then I altered the original version and made room, came up with new grooves with underneath that spot. I mean, the original song is the great Michael Thompson on guitar. Mm-hmm. And I'm playing Hammond and Rhodes and clav and those kind of things, and all the drums and perk. We contoured it for the film.
Okay, and then when you do insert the rap sections, it sounded like it's just programmed rhythm during that section, right? You didn't go in and overdub more drums to fill the space or copy and paste.
No, there was no copy and pasting, but you know, there was programming. Mm-hmm. I may have had some kick and hi-hat in there. When I do things like that, I just don't like it to be a clear-cut right turn. I want everything to be smooth in there. Mm-hmm. And today, everything is machines. So when I play play on a track, I want it to still be smooth through sections, so continuity is the key.
You're thickening up your drum part with the 16th note tambo and the little clap thing.
I hate playing tambo, by the way, but that's me. Yeah.
Okay. See, I wasn't even sure if that was like, you know, that you were just doing some extra 16th hi-hat or something. No, just to get something so you can pull those things out when the vocals come in.
That's right. So anytime the verse, you basically dynamically bring it back. I learned a lot from Quincy as far as production.
And then with Michael Thompson's part there, the bow, 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 the little funky thing. So again, it was that you have a pretty much completely done, and then you draw in other people, or did you have, okay, here's my fake on keyboard what a guitar might do or something, or you're just leaving space? How are you arranging this with the other musicians?
Well, I mean, there were only really a couple of us on here. I mean, you know, welcome to the world of building.
Or was he even doing it from his, with you, or was he sending it over the internet from his?
Actually, and we did a live showcase for Maya, so I put my whole band together with Bobby Watson from Rufus and Michael and Maya's keyboard player. But, you know, I used that concept. Well, I'm actually, you know, we had written this before that. So Michael did it from his home studio and then emailed me these tracks. Mm-hmm. This was the kind of situation where, you know, it wasn't a large MGM budget.
Sure.
You know, these are documentary films.
And I guess it probably wouldn't take too much coaching, at least for this song, for like what the style is. Like, obviously you're doing this deep down groove thing and you knew that this was a something within that he could easily spill out. How does the communication work?
Michael and I go back to Berkeley in 1974.
Ah.
On my second semester, he came into melody and improv class taught by John Laporta, one of my mentors from the Woody Herman band in the old days. And Michael and I immediately hit it off. He and I have got many rock records out, one called TRW for Frontiers in Italy. We had a band called Native Sons, since our names ended in Sun. We had a band called Revolver in the early 90s. So, I mean, he and I have always been very, very close. By yesterday was his birthday. Happy birthday, Mike. So we've always worked well together, and we have probably written 15 songs together. And it's nice, you know, the way we write is, you know, we will just start jamming on something like we used to in the old days. And then something all of a sudden pops out and I'll go, hey, why don't you do this there, sir? It's not unlike Led Zeppelin was in 68 and 9 is the way Mike and I write. So we employed our, you know, our R&B and rock roots with this simplistic vibe that Maya was laying down about one beautiful meaning. Everything's going to be all right.
Let me play just a section. So this is the middle of the first rap section where the second rapper comes in, just to, really to see the transition back to the regular chorus here.
You have to rearrange. Love is all you need from your friends and family. Stitch your heart right on your sleeve. Please believe everything's gonna be all right. So with all your might, you can take all the problems thrown by life.
So like the boom, doo doon, doo doon, doo doon. Like, is that still programming?
No, that's me playing.
Okay, all right. So that's the transition point that you had blips and bloops, and now you're...
Right. I mean, it's nice to have, you know, a massive Pro Tools Ultimate rig, but my A drums are back over there. So what I'll do is I'll see how it's growing and then make that go. And probably, if I'm not mistaken, I came in probably for those last eight bars as the vocals are quadrupling.
Uh-huh.
I start growing and then make it a massive JR drum fill of humanity going back into our original groove.
So that's the second one where they're, yeah, let me play that layered thing. So... Because you already have a lot of dynamics within the sections and breaking it up. So it's less of a single transition out that time. But you have the, yeah, this crazy synth that you're...
That's me and my synth madness. But also, originally, it had gone to the beginning of the vamp fall. And then we decided, because of the film, is to do a breakdown there for four bars.
Yes, okay, yeah, down to just electronic drums and vocals so that you can really have the expressive. Was this just her many times making this choir or with you? Obviously, it'd be easier to get five people to come in and do this together, but is this just a lot of overdubbing or?
It was a lot of overdubbing.
Uh-huh.
And again, documentary film budgets are not large.
Sure.
We're not doing the Last Waltz here. You know, even though I would rather prefer the Last Waltz, but you do it the best you've got. And since Maya sings so well, it was easy to do that.
Yes, and it has that feeling of the big social group. I mean, again, in fitting with the tone of what you're trying to say, you know, it's like the whole classroom and then the individual kid, the rappers are coming out and then they're receding back in the whole chorus and then she gets this vamp above that. The fact that you can do that convincingly with basically just her. And I guess, so yeah, how much are you just singing along with the chorus? I see you have a vocal credit here, but I couldn't specifically hear.
I'm sure I was singing on
okay.
this. What I'll do is, I mean, I was an all-state singer in Iowa back in my sophomore days of high school. My entire quartet made it, and I was a basso profundo. We sang Brahms to make all-state, and it was not easy. And then once I got to Berkeley for extra credit, I joined the choir program because I had the time, even though I probably, you know, didn't. I was a drum set major, but I learned how to sing some really great stuff. So what I'll do when I write is I will sing melodies in my timbre and range and then have, you know, a female boot that up hard. And it actually works.
Pretty much just an octave, so you don't even have to worry about transposing.
And or fifths, yeah.
But yet in your solo albums, I at least haven't noticed that you're not, you know, this is a poem that I wrote that I have to sing myself in my own voice because I'm singing to my ex-wife or whatever like that. It doesn't seem like you've trod that ground.
On my first album, Feng Shui, I recut Cold as Ice by Foreigner. In Cold as Ice, Telling Lies, I wrote a completely new bridge and got songwriters now from Mick Jones. When you listen to that, and I don't know if that was on our list, but it's something people should listen to. I have my singer, Mark Williamson, from Bridge Too Far, the English singer, sing the one part, and then You're As Cold As Ice is me singing on that song.
I will refer people to that, but I do want to, yes, let's transition to get a second song out here. Flight 81 from that album, the opening tune, a nice fusion tune with the big horns and stuff, just to really get something in this genre that you also did programming, keyboards. It says bass, but again,
that is me playing keyboard bass.
Okay, all right.
And you know why that is because I hear things from my drum part that it would take me a while to beat a real bass player up to play that exact way. And I might as well just play it and then fix some stuff that's too much. And that's exactly what went down there.
Yeah. So tell me where you were at in 2004 in deciding to do this is your first official solo album, right?
My first official solo. Yeah. I mean, I always enjoy having band records like Bridge Too Far on CBS. And then we did my solos and then we did TRW. Ironically, I use all initials, which are the guys in the band. And then my last one was SRT, which is more of a jazzy organ trio. But at this point, my second ex-wife and I were on our way from New Jersey back to Los Angeles on United Airlines. And we were taking off and bam, and get up to the cruising altitude. They're bringing us our supper and bada, bada, bang. And all of a sudden, that flight literally stopped in midair. And it was like, it felt like Star Trek. And it literally just hovered there. And all of a sudden, all the oxygen masks blew out. And I just said, oh, fuck. And all of a sudden, the flight started nosing down and just violent descent from 35,000 down to what then eventually was the safe altitude of probably between 14 and 11,000 feet. And that violent descent, we thought we were over. Growing up in Iowa, my dad had small airplanes, so we always flew. So I knew that once the airplane starts dipping over to a 90-degree angle, then you're done and flipped over. Well, we didn't, but it happened so violently, and there was people getting injured and bloody and shit. And I'm just freaking out, and you know, we got a thing, and my wife goes, "You look like a pig. You got a pig nose on," you know, trying to make me laugh, and I'm freaking. And finally, it was 11 minutes or something like that, and it took us to get from Jersey over to the Nashville airspace, and they pulled it out, got it in there, and landed in Nashville. And I was just, you know, soaking wet. Everybody was freaked out. We got off the plane slow. Everybody was freaked out. And I noticed right when I got off the plane, I looked back and immediately the TSA was there and towed the airplane away. Something was screwed up at that plane. I called my father. Once we got back, they put us in some shitty hotel. Next day, I got back to Los Angeles. The first thing I did was write bump, 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 bump. bump, bump. And I figured out, oh, let's make this as out as possible with, you know, flat nines and sharp fives and all this shit.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't sleep for like 4 days. So I wrote that, and I was probably drinking in those days. And so that's how it came. And then I realized, I go, wow, this is really cool. And then I went out and put some dummy drums on it. And I go, okay, this is going to be easy. So as avant-garde as I am, once that song took shape, it became the signature of the beginning of my solo record. In those days, I was still endorsing Zildjian cymbals, and I have these old 1969 to 72 swishes, like what Mel Lewis would play. And I took two of them and put them on the hi-hat stand, which is very unusual. So it's this big, curved-up, riveted noise factor with a hi-hat instead of a regular hi-hats.
Uh-huh.
So if you listen to that, that song has two 22-inch swishes for the entire groove. And then I had, you know, we can talk about personnel in a second. So that's the setup.
Yes, let's play the full song. We'll be right back. actually just from the beginning, your is that just reverse reverb, or are you doing a little tom?
I'm trying to remember how we did that. I mean, that was a while ago.
Yes, I'm getting into details that are, this is multiple decades.
I know there was a reverse swell I used, and I may have figured out how to reverse cymbals via Pro Tools. So it was like, it was probably some reverse swell coming into that hard.
Yeah, I guess this is sort of the same question as with these transitions in the last song that we talked about is, how much do you feel like, you know, how do you determine how much build you need in terms of, you know, your, whether it's a crescendoing synth or a reverse reverb or something, any sort of general, like, is there no, like, it can never be too much.
Well, it could be, but, you know, in this case, I almost died in a fucking plane crash. So I figured, let's wake everybody up right out of the gates, you know, get their attention.
You say you came up with the rhythm and things. When you were laying down the demo of it, was it just something that you then layered over later, or did you get a band in and do some sort of live version of it? What was the order of operations for this one, do you recall?
Ironically, this is one of the first complete songs I had written all by myself. I mean, there's no words, because sure, there aren't words for something like this. But I had this whole thing already done and laid out. And what do? Is I call two of the greatest musicians of all time, the late Gary Grant on trumpet and Dan Higgins on saxophones, and had them do a little horn arrangement around this, and they laid that down separately at, I think it was at Gary's studio in those days. And then Gary'd come out with the files, and I'd load them in and say, yay, and it was all really cool.
See, now you've already got me spinning my imagination when Manhattan Transfer does their version and they add their own lyrics. What's up with this plane? It's... But no, not necessary to get the point across.
I've done about 7 or 8 Manhattan Transfer records, and you wouldn't believe some of the ways we had to work with them. All great, and I miss Timmy dearly.
Do you let the main horn player, the trumpet player, sort of arrange the horns, or are you just, you know, do you have charts?
We did charts, but remember, if you pull the horns out, I'm still playing that on the synth.
Okay.
Or on the piano and the synth, and probably tripling it. So I'm playing all that first. They just took my melody and then wrote around that. But they're basically playing what I'm playing. It's just fattening it. And don't forget one key element. So it's me playing drums, me playing percussion, me playing bass, but Paul Jackson Jr. is playing guitar. I hired Paul to put that funk in there because he's basically adding the glue to all the other stuff.
Yeah, let me play from around 28, just so we can get the transition. There's a full stop before we go to the B section here.
It went right into the chorus.
Yes.
I mean, that could be a B or a C section. It's kind of like a release of the chorus.
Because this mystifies me. I tend to write lyrics and chorus together, and so that sort of determines the structure more or less. But when you're writing instrumentally, are you sort of thinking vocally anyway in terms of, like, these are the melodies? And so, like, did you have that basic synth?
Definitely.
In this case, that sax melody in the B section already worked out, or was that more Dan Higgins?
I think it was more Dan Higgins. You know, it's basically rock and roll changes, but it's funky. Mm-hmm. I think Dan did come up with that line and then made that work as a counterline to the melody. So it's like a yin and a yang thing. There's almost opposites, but they work well together.
Yeah, I guess horns are such a big presence that, you know, either they're gone.
Especially those two gentlemen, yeah.
Yes, and so the fact that he's doing this and then have little blats from the trumpets. Or is he just doing one trumpet, or did he layer a few, do you recall?
There's only two dudes, and they definitely layered at least 3 times.
Sure, sure. Okay, so you're mostly leaving that to their expertise in terms of how to get the energy so that there's enough trumpet increasingly as the sax goes on, so then they can pour into the next section together.
Yeah, and it's arranging tactics from both those two geniuses. And it was really nice because, again, the song was done, and all they did was just fill in the cracks.
Sure.
To complete the task.
Let me play from going into the bridge. That ethereal guitar. Is that's also Paul just doing a second pass, or?
I mean, I can't really tell what Paul's playing there. He could just be playing like arpeggiated.
That's definitely in there. That's the thing that's determining a lot of it. And
that's normally like a Michael Thompson part, but I had Paul on this song. But I wrote a release, and I went to halftime in the drums and used double bass drum pedal and played this. So it's like this up, down, and then it goes to the last two bars, and it just, you know, with the sus chord building back out to the tonic, which A, could be the head, or B, a sax solo. And it's a sax solo in this.
I know this song has a narrative, right? It's the narrative of the plane ride. Is the logic here just musical that you'd wanted to open it up somehow? Or is there also something in your head? Oh, now I'm drifting in the open air. Like, is there a visual component in your head?
Yeah. I'm fucking spinning down to the earth. So Dan Higgins, I think, is playing soprano there on that solo. And it's pretty avant-garde what he's playing.
There we've got some muted stuff and some, you know, very different tone out of the horns that we've been getting. So yeah, we have a soprano solo coming up.
Yeah, that's Dan interpreting my dilemma.
We have a in between those a Latin percussion section. Let me play some of that 157.
Oh yeah, that's me playing timbales.
Okay. Again, sort of what's the feel, especially if you don't have all the instruments there. I understand if you have an ensemble and you can sort of feel how long should this go. But if you don't even know what the horns are going to do.
It didn't matter what the horns were going to do.
Okay.
Because I had already allotted space for me to play that timbale solo. The point is, this is a good song you selected because it has basically every aspect of who I am in this song without being overly produced. And I love playing timbale, so I had an area in my studio where with two separate mics, and I brought in the timbales and a little crash cymbal, and I thought that timbale solo should be notated and put out. It's that good.
Well, yeah, you talk a lot in your book about just adapting your style to the song, and that often means laying back and just, okay, you know, save the chops for the one spot where you can jump in and do the fast riff. And maybe that never happens in so many of these songs that it's just the groove, but now it's solo stuff. So now you can let loose in a way that maybe, I don't know, was this intoxicating enough? You obviously didn't go on to do 10 more of these in this vein immediately after this.
No, but you know, one thing I learned from being Quincy's drummer all those years was you're weaving a story for the whole album process. And I mean, you know, on that album, there's a lullaby I wrote for my son, Jack, who still lives with me. But he was just a little baby in those days. And there was all sorts of other things. I did a tribute to New Orleans in there by doing a Horace Silver song, Sister Sadie. It's basically a journey. But technologically speaking, we did this on a Mackie digital console back in those days. It was really kind of backwards with ADATs.
Okay.
Yeah, those are the old days. The old days.
Does that mean you're programming the fader flying, or you're actually just doing it when you're... Did you mix this? You didn't mix this yourself, right?
Woody Woodruff, the engineer, and I mixed this, yes. You know, now I have a full-on scene here. It's all digital, but I use Steve Sykes, and Steve is actually in Colorado with his studio. Him and his wife moved there, so I have really great ears, thank God, but I'll mix something really quickly. Like, I'll give you an example. Yesterday, I just cut, you know, the band Take Six?
Yeah.
Okay, I've known those guys since they were children, and Brian McKnight, I did his first record, and I just got a call from Claude, and we recut Hoagie Carmichael's Stardust, and I got the files here, and there's nothing on them but vocals. Nothing. And that's how they want it. And they go, we want you to put drums. I go, oh, boy. So this took some really cool deliberation. And I made it work. It's wait till you hear that.
Was there at least a click track? Or it was just vocals?
I put a click in it.
And probably had to move them around to line them up with? Or
I didn't have to move them at all.
Oh.
But, you know, each song I work with captures the mood of the artist and myself because they've asked me to join with them. So I plug myself into these situations and I think what would be best. Now, in you know your case, Mark, you know, you're going down memory lane a little bit here with some old stuff, which are there some nasty stories. I don't know if I'll have to tell you them, but.
All right. We'll get much older very soon. I just want to do a couple of your big old drum fills here. There's one. It's around at 242. I'm going to start at 236. Yeah, just that. Yeah, you know, to get us.
It's a triplet, 16th note triplet. Shaka ta ta ka bop. One, two, shaka ta ta ka bop. So,
bop. And I think it's a pretty subtle, like, it's not like with that lip riff, you could just have everything just stop.
The snare stops on beat four. So it does create a hole, just like the intro to Rock With You.
Yes.
It creates a hole into the next one.
Yes. So, okay. So just the fact that you can get that dramatic move without super calling attention to it. Like, it's not like it's super high in the mix and this is the drummer's album. And now look, I'm doing this. No. And then we, you know, as if you're orchestrating, you know, conducting the.
Listen, there, we know there's enough drummer's albums out there and I've never been wanted to be that guy. I'm a band guy, you know?
All right. Then one more riff just to get us toward the end of the song. Which that one just carries right through, but it's just you're filling up.
I'm playing very Billy Cobham-ish there.
Okay.
Who was one of my great mentors. You know, I mean, look, at I know where it's fading.
Right. It starts to fade at that point, but you're doing more and more interesting drum stuff, but it's sort of, you know, your ego is such that you can allow that to be part of what people are seeing receding into the distance rather than.
That's right.
I'm going to do my most interesting stuff while people are paying attention. Even that giant riff, again. It's just sort of, you don't even stop there. It's just a drum fill. You know, we're just getting to the next section.
Right, and it's just an answer to the, again, that horn riff. And it's going to make people remain interested all the way to, wow, listen to that. I'm going to play that again.
Just to go back to the bass for a second, I wouldn't have known if you hadn't told me that that's keyboard bass, that you're funking that up.
I'm very good at this, even on the Rufus records.
Well, let's go back to, so one of the ones that you had a writing credit on for Rufus was You're Really Out of Line, written with Hawk Wilinski from Seal in Red, 1983. You want to tell us a little about where you're at with that band and making writing contributions to that band before we hear it?
The first song I ever wrote for Rufus was on the Quincy Jones album in 79 Master Jam, and it was called I'm Dancing for Your Love was the name of it.
Yeah, okay.
And it was a great song. It was our third single. But Shaka left the band again, and you know, she'd be like a wandering animal and come back home and then leave, you know. So we were doing solo records. I hired George Duke to produce this record, Seal in Red. And we had a fairly substantial budget on that record with Warner Brothers. And we also brought in Ivan Neville, Aaron Neville's son, into the band because he had this really husky voice and he could also play keys just for that record. So I had an idea, and you know, back, this is all old analog days, you know, in my little simple studio back in whenever this, what year was this? 83?
Yes.
It was during the time where we had gotten back together and then with Shaka and then won the Grammy for With Ain't Nobody. But I had this idea and I ran it by Hawk. And, you know, Hawk, of course, wrote Ain't Nobody and is just, you know, and used to write for Chicago. And he goes, hey, let's add this to that. And then we'll add this to this. We laid it down, I think, on MCI or Sony 2-inch and got the track up and running for us to actually either transfer it over and brought it into another studio so then I could overdub drums and synth bass. So the synth bass is Hawk and myself playing Mini Moog.
Okay.
And the great Kevin Murphy, you know, the old man from the original founder of Rufus, he used to actually tour with Dick Clark in Caravan of Stars in the early 60s.
Okay.
I mean, that's how old those two guys are. We had Kevin use an early vocoder.
Oh, so he's doing the verse vocals. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think George Duke had it. And we used Kevin because we didn't have Shaka at that point. And so that's what happened on there. And there's some really kind of alternative dissension chords on that song, but it's really funky. Then I overdubbed drums after that at a studio. Ooh.
Yeah, so this is one, if you know, you're saying people assume that you start with the drums, but you're saying no, actually did the drums later. And this is an era, you know, 83 through 87, where it's not even really like, are these actual drums? Or are they just so they are actual drums, but they're just processed to hell, so you wouldn't know.
No, I don't know about process. That was Tommy Vaccari, you know, the great engineer for the Oscars, and our original engineer with Stanley Clarke and George Duke. And, you know, of all those records I did with them. And, you know, it was just using analog, reverbs. And we didn't gate, but there were like shorter fats vibe. And I always had a fat sound anyway when I don't have that thin, jazzy, high-pitched, thin drumhead sound, even though if I choose to do that, I have that. So that's what that is.
Well, but there's even right at the beginning, there's a... The again, sort of reverse reverb, which is very easy to do digitally, but analog, you know, I had a four-track cassette one where you just turn it upside down and record the reverb going backwards.
Yeah, and George, and then we had another engineer named Eric Zobler, who's still around, and George was one of the first ones that had a digital console back in those days, but we had analog machines. We would cut a lot of it up at his place, Legonx West, and then take it in, and I can't remember if I overdubbed drums there. I think we went into another studio. But, you know, George Duke was one of the greatest piano players of all time, and we had already two other keyboard players, plus myself, plus George, so, you know, we were pulling out the stops.
So then when you go to do this live, is it a complete different arrangement in terms of who's actually going to cover what?
Guess what? We never played this live.
Oh, okay.
Because when we got back live, who were we with? Shaka. So then we basically took the Rufus hits and a couple of hers. We chose not to do that when we toured with that. But I always wanted to do this live because it's fun. But you would have had to have had a vocoder guy singing that way. you know, to make it authentic.
Let me play a little of the chorus here. I had noted in particular, sort of, there's an extra snare hit maybe on the end of three a couple times that doesn't sound like this is a preset on the drum machine. Just that extra little...
Yeah, that's something I think that we came through one of George's synths.
Okay.
That I'm playing, one, two, three, four, at.
Yep.
I also, one other thing in mind, on certain things, I was still using Simmons drums, which were analog, they were kind of awful.
The first electronic drums, is that what you're...
No, they were the second, actually. Okay. Syndrums were the first. Mm. But I used to tour for Simmons... I'll give you an example for the people would have been Yamo Be There that I did for Quincy, for Mike and James Ingram. And it's Yamo Be There. Doosh, 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 doosh. Those were Simmons toms.
Okay.
That I overdubbed. But there may be something on this Rufus record that we snuck in.
Yes, I saw Bruford on the Anderson Bruford Wakeman Howe tour. So 89, still within this general. I don't know if he was still using Simmons, but I recall one of the reviews I read, like, I don't trust anybody that has to plug in their drums, because that was at least a brief period where he was doing only that.
My whole consensus was I was going to take the SDS-7 brain and go up to a second story, go down below with a shotgun mic and record it smashing into the cement and then using that sample.
Okay. Let me play some of this instrumental, the synth-led bridge. I really like this part. This is kind of what made me for sure want to do this rather than the first song you had written, because this is just so fruity. Yeah, between that very percussive, that is guitar, right?
That's Tony Maiden playing guitar, but that's all me playing synths in the lead line there.
Ah.
No, it's me and my Berkeley brain going to work there. You know, you're going to write a bridge, write a damn bridge. You know, it's something that takes you from, you know, point A to point B. And that's what that is.
Yeah, it has some of the same DNA that's in Flight 81 in the lines you wrote for that. Very cool part. Yeah, I wrote, what do drums do during that? Because it's so filled, so you're just keeping something very basic under that?
It's straight with a syncopation.
Oh, okay.
Three, four, one, and a two, but a dot, but a da 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 da. And that's, you know, not unlike Ain't Nobody, where we did that stop like that.
Okay, yes. There's always the question, like, we didn't even really talk about how Flight 81, for the B section, you switch, I believe, and if I'm remembering my songs correctly... One of the songs, you switch over to the ride for, you know, for every B section or something like that. But I don't think that was necessary. Right. It's not a cymbal-y song. So it's not the normal.
On Out of Line, no.
On Out of Line, yep.
That timbre or part was reflected from that really weird, like, mini-mook synth.
All right, let me play a little around 218. We have the Ivan vocal coming in. Ivan has been on this show before. I was very excited to hear his voice. In there.
Oh, there you go. I miss him. I'd love to get back together with him, but we're so far away from each other, you know. What a voice on him.
We're muting the horns temporarily. It said James Panko was playing trombone. Yep. In this. Okay.
Yeah, we brought Jimmy in, because Jimmy's a friend of ours, and, you know, Hawk and Jimmy grew up together.
Okay. Yeah. So if it sounds like Chicago, it is up here.
It is. Yeah. Well, from the trombone based. Yeah. Jerry and Gary and maybe Larry and all those guys from Jerry's horn section there too.
So was this section part of your initial idea, or was that Hawks adding something? Do you recall?
All of us, but George Duke being the head producer. So yeah, you know, let's bring in Jerry and the boys and put an arranged horn part on here.
Uh-huh. But even just having like a regular voice come in to give people a break. It is like that airy sec. It's just like in Flight 81 where you bring in that we gotta change things up to just let the tension out a little bit.
Going backwards, so that initial weird bridge that I wrote is a kind of a semi-bridge that leads into the Ivan real bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes into the Ernie Watts solo.
Yeah, how do you usually think? I write bridge one and bridge two, or like, I don't know how to...
In today's times... people are so impatient. They don't want to allow musicality to step up generally. Everybody's just in such a hurry for the same thing. And this is pop music. I don't care if it's funky or whatever. It's still under the pop category. You should be able to do things, you know.
You know, we didn't really talk about lyric writing with the first song that you had written, co-written the lyrics with. Did the lyrics come from you on this one, at least to start with? Do you recall?
I'd have to reflect that.
Okay.
Being a co-writer, then you do have your lyrics. Yeah, I mean, we're all sitting there with lyrics. And if there's a line you don't like, you make a note. And then you write a different line, and then you submit it in a democratic process.
It's not a message that's so specific and personal that you would have to like, oh, this is my poem. You're dissing someone in this. And well, I didn't have lyrics written in front of me, so I wasn't even, you're always quick to judge, you walk around so something, but as the season ends, your record's still a nimbus. Is that what, do you even recall?
That must have come out of Hawk's mouth.
Okay. All right. And then, yes, you mentioned the big tenor sax that comes in at the end.
Ernie Watts.
And we have another fade. Was it just the style of the time fading? Most musicians that I talk to, because I guess they primarily play live and then they transmit it to the... But fading is sort of a seldom used trick, but it seems at least two of the songs we've covered, we've got that in here. What is your general philosophy of fading?
I learned a lot from the great Bruce Swedeen, who was one of the greatest engineers of all time. And later in recording consoles, there's an actual fade button, and you can program it. You can put 90 seconds, 60 seconds, 45 seconds, 30 seconds. You can do it automatically. But in the beginning days, you would literally hear it musically and pull that fader down. And it was an art form. It was like, you know, how I play drums. It was watching an engineer pull a fader down and just be perfect. And during those Quincy days, Quincy would sit there on the side of Bruce while Bruce did it, and he'd look over at him and he would go, just give me one more. I want to hear one more kick drum point. And he'd go, beautiful sense. But then later, Bruce figured out on these generic Michael Jackson dance endings, he just programmed 90-second, which is a really long fade.
Yeah.
I watched him. He'd hit a 60-second button and literally just come back and put his feet up. And I'm like, shit, really? You don't want to fade it like at 48 seconds? You know, I'm thinking.
I mean, a three-minute pop song, like 90 seconds is ridiculous.
You know, Off the Wall and Bad, and especially on Bad, where I was running a slave 2-inch machine with 16-track heads with the larger 2-inch tape. So take a song like Bad, I would have to play the same groove for 8 straight minutes. So there were no fades. So they had all that information to come back into their other digital tapes and then determine, well, all right, that's 12-inch. This is going to go there. This is going to go there for a quick single. This is going to be cut out here for that. So there would be all these different kinds of fades. In this Rufus situation, you know, that's Tommy Vaccari and George Duke determining what's the best part of the song that leaves people wanting more.
Sure. All right, to close out here, I wanted to include, so it's a Tal Shaya, Shia, how do you want to?
Tal Shaya, it came out of me and Spock.
Oh, okay. By your current group, SRT, from Vanguards of Groove, with Mitch Town playing keyboards and, does he just do bass with his feet? Is that what I'm seeing?
No, he does bass with his left hand and a little bit with his feet. He's a Hammond organ whiz from Missouri Valley, Iowa, but Omaha, Nebraska.
And Andrew, pronounce his last name?
Sinewick.
Sinewick on guitar. Younger guys? Yeah, do you want to say anything to introduce this project and this song before we say goodbye here?
This project came out of COVID. I'm from Creston, Iowa, so I was back doing a benefit for Walter Scott, the great billionaire and he's passed, unfortunately, from Omaha. Him and Warren Buffett were two of the richest men in the world. And we used to go back and do benefits. We did his 90th birthday party for Walter Scott. And, you know, we bring in the David Foster stuff and do our show stuff. And Mitch is there. And he comes up to me, he goes, my name's Mitch Town. And he goes, I know you're from Creston and blah, blah, blah. And I'm a Hammond organ player. And have you ever thought about doing a trio? He said to me, and I'm kind of packing up my little hi-hat clutch and getting ready to get the hell out of there. And he goes, I have actually. And so we kept in touch. And through that whole time, then we started writing via Zoom I really wanted to get a guitar player, and we got to figure out which guitar player, because, you know, typical organ trios like Jimmy Smith or Joey DeFrancesca, you know, they all had a certain guitar player with them. Some were really simple 7-string jazz players, 6-string. So, you know, we went through a concept of, well, let's get George Benson, you know, and just start working stuff down. Let's go that way. Now let's go this way. And then all of a sudden I did a movie called Bullet Train.
Mm-hmm.
And Andrew Sinewick and I were in the rhythm section, and he was like the new young Dean Parks of Los Angeles studio scene. So I go, hey, you know, you'd be interested in doing some stuff with us. And so we started this thing and started all three of us collectively and democratically writing. And that's how it happened. Now, Tal Shaya, I had written before during COVID, because I'm a Star Trek nut. I always have been, original Star Trek. You know, Spock could obviously do the pinch, right, to nullify anything, and the guy would pass out. Well, Tal Shaya only happens once in one episode, where it's called almost like the Vulcan death grip, and he can literally kill a person with this grip. And it's only used once. And so I remembered that, wrote it down, and started writing this song around that. I mean, I wrote something and I go, how about that title? I'm going to plug that in because it's jazz. You know, nobody knows what the hell you're, I mean, I'm writing about the inner mounting flame, you know.
I did not remember the actual term for that, but Vulcan death grip is definitely something that was, you know, within our childhood screwing around repertoire.
And I don't even know if it, listen, honest to God, I don't even know if it's spelled correctly, but I said it looks really good as Tal Shaya. It's kind of like my first solo record was Funk Shui. It's not even a real word.
Sure.
But it's stuck, and it seems to be, like I hear people on NBC going, well, that's very Funk Shui of you. I go, well, thank you.
Is there anything else that you are working on, have recently finished, want to promote that you want to tell us about for a minute before we wrap?
You know, I started a third solo record quite a while ago, and there's some really avant-garde stuff on there. I mean, there's a song that's it's done called My Washing Machine. This is not anything huge, but it's fun. My old machine, I'm here during, you know, post-COVID, and I hear the machine going through its fast reciprocal cycle. I go, shit, where's my sampler? So I walked in and sampled it, then brought it back in and loaded it into Pro Tools, fixed it, found the best one, and wrote a song. And it's kind of like a, you know, it's like that tempo. And it's just, it's unbelievable. And I'm singing on it with a real low voice. And, you know, I think that probably going to have to come out. I don't really care what people think. It's kind of fun. But that's not a priority. The priority has been the book, King of the Groove. And what's happening now is I've signed a deal with a company called Bedside Manor. In 5 days of sales, ebooks will sell between 1,000 and 3,000 copies and guarantee bestseller status. At that point, we go from there. I'm working on the audio book with another microphone here, which is really hard. It's really hard to do. And so you have to do it verbatim, each word, and not sound like a dork. So I'm doing that. That'll be done. At the same time, I formed a publishing company with my partner, Allison, and it's called Fourth Quarter Press Publishing. And this is going to be for seasoned individuals from 50 up. I mean, I'm not really cutting them off, but who have started their memoirs or a book. I don't care if it's fiction or not. And we will get it and publish it with this whole thing. So that's, I think, going to be a really huge step. There's a potential of a new me doing the music to a new film, a football movie. That's filmed in Pennsylvania. Me as the head composer, and that's not come through yet. And then I'm getting my doctorate from Iowa State University.
Oh.
And it'll be Doctor of Music Ed. I'll be going back there in May to wear a cap and gown. I'm still doing dates here. And
yeah, you were just on two different little touring jags. In terms of your day, how much is studio work versus your own stuff versus playing other...
At this point, now that I'm off tour, you know, I just got back from... it was the Chris Bodie Jazz Tour, and we started out in Fort Lauderdale. And we did a gig in Orlando first, and then got on the boat, and then sailed all the way out into the waves, and then did a couple of shows, and ended up in Cozumel. Well, it sounds romantic, but I ended up getting right back on a plane and coming back to Los Angeles. That's with David Foster. The next gig I got with him is we do a thing for cancer in Scottsdale in March. and then they probably won't tour with him until September. And that could be the whole South East and Australia at that point, and they'll be doing a Christmas tour. So in between that, I'm going to be doing all the stuff for myself.
All right. So far from retired. Still plenty of things.
Hey, I can't retire. Jeez. I mean, what am I going to do?
Stepping back and writing a book? I didn't know, you know. Sounds great.
Yeah.
All right. So here it is. Tal Shaya from by SRT is the band name, Vanguards of Groove 2023. Thanks so much for chatting.
All right, man. My pleasure, Mark.
Thanks so much to John. Again, I want to refer folks to his King of the Groove book, where he tells about all the many sessions and tours and things we didn't talk about. He has played extensively with Barbra Streisand. He played on albums by Robbie Robertson, Brian Ferry, Peter Cetera, Mike Oldfield, Eric Clapton, Rod Stewart, Lady Gaga, Clint Black, Toby Keith, Daft Punk, Michael McDonald, Madonna, Bob Seger. He toured with Peter Frampton. I will link to more of his performances from the blog post associated with this episode at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. But again, you can find more about him at johnjrrobinson.com. This interview is a long time coming. It's actually been almost 2 months since my last interview. I've sort of slowed down my release to probably one every 3 or 4 weeks just to make things easier on myself. But this got further delayed by the fires in LA where John lives. His power went out. My next scheduled interview is with Peter Halsapple, best known for his work with the DBs, along with my past guest, Chris Stamey. So I'm looking forward to that one. I hope you're all doing well, ever discovering new music, being creative, enjoying your life. Until next time, keep on musicking. This is Mark Lindsay Meyer signing off.